Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, September 21st, 2022. Federal Reserve increasing interest rates by 0.75 percentage point in the latest effort to deal with high inflation, and the Fed chair warning that the unemployment rate will likely go up as well, saying if we want to light the way to another period of very strong labor market, we've got to get inflation behind us. I wish there were a painless way to do that. There isn't. We'll hear from the Fed chair and talk with MarketWatch senior reporter Greg Robb. New York Attorney General Letitia James announcing a civil lawsuit against former President Donald Trump, plus three of his children, his company, and two of its executives, alleging what she says was staggering business fraud, that they inflated the former president's net worth for personal gain, for instance, getting better loan terms from banks. U.S. House representatives today passing a bill to change and clarify how electoral votes are counted and contested, all to lessen the chance of another violent day like the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, by supporters of Donald Trump after he lost his re-election bid. President Joe Biden addressing the United Nations General Assembly, condemning what he says is a brutal, needless war, a war chosen by one man, referring to Russian President Vladimir Putin and the invasion of Ukraine. President Biden also urging the leaders of other nations to continue to hold Russia accountable for trying to eliminate what he calls Ukraine's right to exist as a state. We start with the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell. The announcement today of another increase in the Fed's benchmark interest rates, made necessary, he says, due to persistently high inflation.
The Fed's monetary policy actions are guided by our mandate to promote maximum employment and stable prices for the American people. My colleagues and I are acutely aware that high inflation imposes significant hardship as it erodes purchasing power, especially for those least able to meet the higher costs of essentials, like food, housing, and transportation. We are highly attentive to the risks that high inflation poses to both sides of our mandate, and we are strongly committed to returning inflation to our 2% objective. At today's meeting, the committee raised the target range for the federal funds rate by 0.75 percentage point, bringing the target range to 3 to 3.25%. And we are continuing the process of significantly reducing the size of our balance sheet, which plays an important role in firming the stance of monetary policy. Over coming months, we will be looking for compelling evidence that inflation is moving down, consistent with inflation returning to 2%. We anticipate that ongoing increases in the target range for the federal funds rate will be appropriate. The pace of those increases will continue to depend on the incoming data and the evolving outlook for the economy.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell at today's news conference at Fed headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is the fifth interest rate hike this year and the third in a row at the 0.75 basis point level. During the Q&A with reporters today, Fed Chair Powell asked about what is known as a soft landing, whether a recession can be avoided as interest rates rise and the economy slows and unemployment goes up.
Do the odds now favor, given where you are and where you're going with interest rates, favor a recession? 4.4% unemployment is about 1.3 million jobs. Is that acceptable job loss? And then given that the data you look at is backward-looking and the lags in your policy are forward-looking and you don't know what they are, how will you know, or will you know, if you've gone too far?
So I don't know what the odds are. I think that there's a very high likelihood that we'll have a period of what I've mentioned is below trend growth, by which I mean much lower growth, and we're seeing that now. So the median forecast, I think, this year for among my colleagues and me was 0.2% growth. So that's very slow growth, and then below trend next year. I think the median was 1.2, also well below. So that's a slower that's a very slow level of growth, and it could give rise to increases in unemployment. But I think that is something that we think we need to have, and we think we need to have softer labor market conditions as well. We're never going to say that there are too many people working, but the real point is this. Inflation, what we hear from people when we meet with them is that they really are suffering from inflation. And if we want to set ourselves up, really, really light the way to another period of a very strong labor market, we have got to get inflation behind us. I wish there were a painless way to do that. there isn't. So what we need to do is get rates up to the point where we're putting meaningful downward pressure on inflation, and that's what we're doing. And we certainly don't hope. We certainly haven't given up the idea that we can have a relatively modest increase in unemployment. Nonetheless, we need to complete this task.
Well, how will you know, or will you know, if you've gone too far?
It's hard to hypothetically deal with that question. I mean, our really tight focus now continues to be ongoing rate increases to get the policy rate up where it needs to be. And as I said, you can look at this SEP as today's estimate of where we think those rates would be. Of course, they will evolve over time.
More on the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell's news conference. Joining us on the phone is Greg Robb, senior reporter with MarketWatch. Thanks for doing this. Well, if someone asked you what the future holds for the economy and the Fed's actions, what did you hear today?
We heard Chair Powell sort of double down on his message that he is going to be aggressive about inflation and that interest rates, the Fed benchmark rate, is going to go up a lot higher than people had thought. For most of the year, the Fed was really cautious and didn't think that rates were going to go above 4%. And now 4%, they've kind of breached it this year. They think they're going to get it there by the end of the year. And then they think they're going to go, rates are going to even higher and kind of get into the neighborhood of 5% sometime next year. You know, at least 12 officials were kind of getting to that range close to 5%. So this is a Fed that wants to get interest rates up. They believe that it'll slow down the economy and that it'll cool inflation.
And what about the unemployment rate? Where is that expected to head?
The Fed thinks their forecast today were a little bit grim about the economy. They think they cut their forecast for growth and they raised their forecast for unemployment, but not by too much. They think that unemployment rate, which is now 3.7, is going to get up to 4.4%. So that is significant rise, but it is not a really big rise. And Powell did use in his press conference, there's one place where he sort of tried to say that the unemployment rate might not kind of get out of hand and that joblessness might not get out of hand, even as the Fed is raising rates. It's sort of this thing that this time is different. We're coming out of the pandemic. That kind of talk gets economists to start bouncing up and down. So there's a lot of people who disagree with that, but that's where Chair Powell came down today.
We've had 5 rate hikes so far this year, 3 of them the 0.75 percentage point. Historically, right, where does that fall in terms of Fed's aggressiveness? Have we been through this before?
The last time they did something like this, it was 1980s, very early, the 1980 and 81, under the legendary Fed chairman, Paul Volcker. So, yeah, we haven't seen this. Nobody on Wall Street who's, you know, not too many people on Wall Street were trading at the time of the 1980s. So we're all kind of relearning those lessons. And it is a kind of, a lot of economists think that the Fed is just kind of, you know, like going down the highway too fast and they're going to miss their exit. A lot of the questions today from reporters, I would say, you know, like 5 of them maybe were saying like, how are you going to know when it's time to slow down, Chair Powell? How do you know when it's time to, you know, kind of ease back a little bit? And Powell's answer, he was sort of being tough and just saying like, you know, we're trying to get inflation down here, folks, and that is our main goal. So he wasn't really kind of entertaining this thing about going off an exit. He even said to the first reporter who asked this, he said to them, like, before I answer you, I just want you to say, you know, refer to my Jackson Hole speech, where that was like a super tough speech he gave just at the end of last month, where he said inflation was, you know, that they had to get it down, and he was very harsh. So there wasn't a lot of talk about that, but people are worried about that, and there's a lot of commentary like that.
We're talking with Greg Robb from MarketWatch. You mentioned Wall Street. The Dow was down today, but not as much as some people might expect, I guess. Have they grown accustomed to what's happening here?
I don't know. Fed Chairman Powell has had an ability to kind of calm markets. Like all year, even though the Fed was gearing up to be kind of hawkish, it's kind of, he has this kind of language that Wall Street kind of likes. And I think the last time they had press conferences, the market, last nine times the Fed, he's had a press conference, the market went up. It didn't, the Dow went down 500 points a day. The market does not like the sense that interest rates are going to go above 4.5% sometime next year and get close to 5%. That's getting really close to this level of things are going to break. And a lot of things that are going to break are like financial things that are going to break. And so the market didn't like that number, no matter what Powell kind of had to say. So I don't think the market really liked it. We'll see. Tomorrow we'll know for sure. I mean, tomorrow things happen. We'll see how the market does, but I think that the market really wasn't pleased.
And final question, and again, looking at history, the Federal Reserve created to avoid the economic roller coaster of boom and bust. Has COVID-19 challenged that?
100%. I think we're dealing with the pandemic, when it hit, the Fed was confounded by it. They didn't really know how to act. They slashed rates. We had a recession, but people remember, the recession only lasted a little bit of time. And the Fed really kind of kept policy easy. But it turns out, you know, that the pandemic kind of confused everyone, and the economy's kind of come roaring back. So the Fed is playing catch up now. Inflation's kind of got out of control. But I do think they were in a situation that they were trying to protect people. That was the most important job that they saw coming out of the pandemic. The fact that the economy roared back to life and we got inflation isn't great in the long run, but in a sense, it's better that they protected everyone, because if they hadn't protected people and something worse could have happened, then, you know, it would have been a different story. So it is good that, you know, you have to give them some kind of credit, but now they are behind the eight ball with inflation. They're hustling, trying to get it down. It's not the end of the world, so we'll see how they do in the next 12 months.
Greg Robb, senior reporter with MarketWatch. Find his stories at marketwatch.com. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
And you can also find those MarketWatch stories on Twitter at MKTWEconomics. Dow Jones Industrial Average on Wall Street down 522, NASDAQ down 204, S&P down 66. AAA says the national average of a price of gasoline in the U.S. rose a penny today versus Tuesday to $3.68 a gallon, but it ends months of declines following the highest levels ever in June of over $5 a gallon. C-SPAN's Capitol Hill producer Craig Kaplan tweeting, the U.S. House has passed a bill providing relief to borrowers who consolidated federal student loan debt with a spouse and now need to separate their loans in case of divorce or domestic violence. The vote was 232-193. The Senate passed this Joint Spousal Consolidation Loan Separation Act back in June by unanimous consent, no objections, and so it now heads to the White House, expected signature into law by President Biden. Inflation also a topic at today's House Financial Services Committee hearing with the CEOs of the largest retail banks in the country. The title of the hearing from a Democratic majority called them mega banks. Congresswoman Ann Wagner is a Republican from Missouri. Here are her questions to the CEO of Bancorp, Andrew Cesari, and the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, Jane Fraser.
Recent consumer price index numbers showed inflation is not going away anytime in the near future. Everything costs more now, and low to middle-income Americans are hurt the most. Mr. Cesari and Ms. Fraser, in your opinion, I know that the ranking member touched on some of the implications of sustained inflation, particularly on consumers' credit and the economy, but in terms of the level of savings and credit card debt, what are you seeing on the ground from your customers, your clients? Mr. Cesari.
Thank you, Representative. You are correct that inflation is impacting those who can afford it the least. While consumer spend levels in total are about 10% above last year, the things that people are spending money on have changed substantially. For from discretionary to non-discretionary items like food and gas, as you mentioned. And I think it's appropriate that we're very focused on inflation because, again, it is most harmful for those who afford it the least.
And are you seeing, in fact, credit card debt go up and savings go down?
Savings levels continue to be above pre-pandemic levels across all stratas of deposit levels, from 2 to 4 times. However, they're stabilized. For 18 months, they were growing each and every month, and they've stabilized the last 3 months. Credit card spend rates continue to be high, and payment rates are actually starting to normalize, but still well above pre-pandemic levels.
Thank you. Ms. Frazier, please.
Thank you very much. I would say that it's early days still in terms of seeing the impact of high interest rates on the consumer in the States. Fortunately, they entered this period with pretty strong balance sheets. But we would anticipate that if interest rates remain high in order to tame inflation, that we will see greater stress, particularly in the lower FICO scores, in credit, and that we will also see the savings rates coming down further than we have done. I think we're fortunate to have had the consumer in good health entering into this, but we do expect we're going to be in for tougher times ahead.
J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jane Frazier and Bancorp CEO Andrew Cesari, questioned by Congresswoman Ann Wagner, Republican from Missouri, at today's House Financial Services Committee hearing. Also testifying, the CEOs of Bank of America, Citigroup, and PNC Financial Services Group. It was an all-day hearing. There are over 50 House members on that committee. Economic topics of all stripes covered, and C-SPAN cameras were there. Find the full video at cspan.org. This is Washington Today. New York Attorney General Letitia James announcing a fraud lawsuit against former President Donald Trump, 3 of his adult children, the company called the Trump Organization, and also 2 of its executives, alleging that for 20 years they inflated the former president's net worth by billions of dollars and cheated lenders and others with false and misleading financial statements.
The examples I laid out just barely scratched the surface of the misconduct that we have uncovered. The complaint, which all of you should have a copy, is more than 280 pages long. It includes examples from 23 assets that were grossly and fraudulently inflated. And those inflated values were used on Mr. Trump's statements almost every year. All told, we uncovered more than 200 examples of false and misleading asset valuations that were used on his statements. The pattern of fraud and deception that was used by Mr. Trump and the Trump Organization for their own financial benefit is astounding. Inflating the values of assets by whatever means necessary to increase Mr. Trump's purported net worth. And then that net worth was used to further enhance his financial standing, intentionally misrepresenting his financials to obtain incredible economic benefit. It was a scheme that by its very nature became more profitable over time. And it is all in stark violation of the law.
New York Attorney General Letitia James holding a news conference in New York City today. The civil lawsuit that she filed seeks $250 million in damages and a prohibition on any of the Trumps leading a company in the state of New York. She has also referred this matter to the IRS and federal prosecutors for possible criminal prosecution. Former President Trump posting a response, again calling, as he has in the past, the Attorney General and the investigation a politically motivated witch hunt and personally her racist. She is black. Donald Trump also writing, I never thought this case would be brought until I saw her really bad poll numbers, referring to her reelection bid. Former president goes on, she is a fraud who campaigned on a Get Trump platform, despite the fact that the city is one of the crime and murder disasters of the world under her watch. The nominee for archivist at the U.S. Archives and Records Administration testifying today before the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, talking about the FBI's raid on Mar-a-Lago, former President Trump's home, and it was the Records Administration that referred the matter to the FBI. This was after the former president returned 15 boxes of documents that contained dozens of records with classified markings. And this came up today during the confirmation hearing with Colleen Shogan. Here are the questions from Senator James Lankford, Republican from Oklahoma.
You and I also spoke about the raid that happened in Mar-a-Lago, former President Trump's private residence, and going through those documents. In an unusual situation, it wasn't just the FBI carrying out the raid, but it was the request of the National Archives to be able to engage with these records and then trigger something with the FBI. Typically, this would be a voluntary conversation. It's my understanding that you've had dialogue with our staff to say all of your preferences, any disagreements in this document, this should be a voluntary conversation rather than a legal conversation or a raid. A raid of a former president's house is unprecedented, and it puts the entire process on full display to be able to say, how does this happen? Why does this happen? Everyone gets questions on it. So my first of the question is, should this be a voluntary cooperation rather than a legal raid with a search warrant coming into a private residence?
Well, thank you, Senator, for that question. I want to be clear that as the nominee for this position, I have not been briefed on any of the details of what has happened. So I have no information about those decisions or the sequence of events. But as I understand it, when there is some concern about missing or damaged records in general at the National Archives, at that point in time, the records, to retrieve the records, there is a voluntary exchange of communication with those individuals. And as I understand it, once again, I don't have any past knowledge of this, the vast majority of the time, the records are recovered and retrieved.
Right. This is unprecedented for a former president, obviously, to be able to go through this. The reason I ask you is because that has now set a new precedent that going forward, this is going to be the new standard for every president after this. And so this starts a very different process that we're trying to evaluate. Second part of my question on this is, this is the National Archives, the keeper of all records on this. Now the email chains, the conversations, any notes that were done for the National Archives in their communication with the FBI about this now become national historical records and are not only important to be able to maintain and to be able to protect, but also for the visibility of this committee as well. It's the reason that Senator Scott and I have both reached out to this committee to be able to say, we need to be able to talk about this because there was something entirely new that was just created by the National Archives and the FBI in searching a former president's house. Will you agree to, in the future, making records available at the National Archives to be able to show what the process was and the decision-making was to be able to reach to this point so they'll have greater transparency for the American people?
Yes. Thank you, Senator, for that question. Yes, I believe that transparency with this committee, I want to be responsive to requests if I am confirmed as Archivist of the United States. Once again, I do want to state I don't know where we are in this Department of Justice law enforcement process. But as a general statement, Senator, you have my commitment that I will work with you and members of this committee to be as transparent as possible. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions to Colleen Shogan, nominated for Archivist at the National Archives and Records Administration. The questions from Senator James Lankford, Republican from Oklahoma, at today's hearing of the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Colleen Shogan has worked in the past at the Congressional Research Service, the Library of Congress, and the White House Historical Association, today pledging to be nonpartisan. But some Republican senators on the committee say, as Associated Press put it, that they latched on to an academic article Shogan wrote in 2007 about Republican anti-intellectualism as they questioned her ability to be nonpartisan. And Shogan pointed to her decades of service at the nonpartisan offices. House representatives today passing a bill to change the Electoral Count Act. It's a law from the 1880s. The changes, the goal of helping to prevent post-presidential election violence like what happened with the attack on the U.S. Capitol January 6, 2021, when supporters of former President Trump tried to disrupt the certification of Joe Biden's victory. The bill today was introduced by two members of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6 attack on the Capitol, Democrat Zoe Lofgren and Republican Liz Cheney. Congresswoman Lofgren led off the debate.
In revising the Electoral Count Act and related laws, that no way condones the actions of the ex-president and his allies. Indeed, Dr. John Eastman openly admitted that his plan violated the Electoral Count Act President Trump was told the same. But this bill will make it harder to convince people that they have the right to overthrow the election. Here's a few things the bill does. First, this bill reaffirms that the vice president's authority at the electoral count is ministerial. The vice president's authority has always been ministerial and always will be ministerial. But as we saw in 2020, the ex-president Trump and his allies sought to unlawfully exploit the ECA to suggest otherwise. The bill will also enact new electoral counting rules for Congress. Previously, just a few members of each House were able to derail the proceedings with frivolous objections. That will no longer be the case. Under this bill, no objection will be heard unless one-third of each House supports it. And the only objections that will be permitted are those that are rooted in the Constitution itself, a narrow set of issues. The bill also prevents state and local election subversion. For example, governors will be required to submit their state's lawful certificate of appointment, and federal courts will be empowered to force them to do so if they refuse. Ultimately, this bill is about protecting the will of the American voters, which is a principle that is beyond partisanship. The bottom line is this: if you want to object to the vote, you better have your colleagues and the Constitution on your side. Don't try to overturn our democracy.
Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, Democrat from California, a member of the January 6th committee, also the chair of the House Administration Committee, on the House floor today, one of the main sponsors of this bill. Rising to oppose the bill, Congressman Barry Loudermilk, Republican from Georgia.
I agree that we ought to take a closer look at the Electoral College Act. I agree that we should clarify some of the mechanisms of the act, and I certainly agree that we should be working to prevent another breach of security of this Capitol, as we saw on January 6th. With all that said, we can't afford a one-sided, no-compromises discussion crafted by a partisan select committee, which is what we're being presented with this bill, at least from the perception that we have at this moment. So my question is, why now? Why has the January 6th committee chosen this moment to pursue this legislation instead of working together in a true bipartisan manner, engaging Republicans and Democrats together in a broader perspective? We see the American people are smart enough and they know the answer to this question. The January 6th committee has really wasted more than a year instead of looking into how the security of this building was breached. They've been looking for a year for evidence of some vast conspiracy on January 6, 2021, with nothing to show for it. They spent days falsely accusing myself and some of my other colleagues of wrongdoing in the days prior to the January 6 incidents without producing any substantial evidence to back up their claims. Why? Because it doesn't exist. Now, with midterm elections looming and the prospect of a new majority in the House and the Senate, they feel they need to justify the time they've wasted by inserting themselves into what was once a bipartisan, bicameral discussion of Electoral Count Reform Act. In the meantime, House Republicans have taken concrete steps to promote confidence in elections at every level of government. We've introduced legislation that would reaffirm states' constitutional sovereignty over elections rather than trampling it. We've done this because the American people are tired about hearing about January 6th. American people care about the growing cost of living, the declining economy, and the uncontrolled spending which has caused mass inflation. American people want to be confident that their vote counts in every election, that they can trust the ballot box, and their concerns won't be ignored by lawmakers in Washington.
Congressman Barry Loudermilk, Republican from Georgia, on the House floor. The House went on to pass this bill by a vote of 229-203, nine Republicans joining all the Democrats in voting yes to pass it. It now heads over to the Senate, where the leaders of the Senate Rules and Administration Committee are working on their own version of Electoral Count Act reform. The chair, Amy Klobuchar, a Democrat, and the ranking Republican, Roy Blunt. The story from The Hill: House Democrats have reached a long, elusive agreement on a package of police and community safety bills, according to several of the top stakeholders, with plans for the lower chamber to vote Thursday to send the legislation to the Senate. The deal arrives after months of tense talks between moderate Democrats, who have been pushing for a vote on the pro-police package ahead of the midterm elections, and liberals leery of showering new funds on law enforcers without new safeguards for curbing police abuse. That was reporting from The Hill. The debate scheduled to begin about 9 a.m. Eastern on Thursday. You can listen to it live here on C-SPAN Radio. Of course, it'll be on C-SPAN Television, also on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. President Joe Biden, in a speech at the United Nations General Assembly in New York City, saying Russia has violated the core tenets of UN membership by invading Ukraine, and that President Vladimir Putin is making reckless and irresponsible threats to use nuclear weapons. We'll hear from President Biden in just a moment. First, here is President Putin in a televised address from Tuesday night.
In their aggressive anti-Russian policies, the West has crossed the line. We keep hearing threats against our country, against our people. Certain irresponsible politicians from the West, they don't just say about their plans to supply long-range assault weapons to Ukraine, systems that would allow them to strike Crimea and other regions of Russia. Such terrorist attacks, including using the Western weapons, are also used against the Belgorod and Kursk regions, using the contemporary systems, aviation, satellites, strategic unmanned aerial vehicles. And NATO is performing reconnaissance across the entire Russian border. In Washington, London, Brussels, they push Kyiv to try to move hostilities to our territories. They don't even hide it when they are saying that Russia should be destroyed at the field of battle, and they should deprive us of any kind of sovereignty. They should rob our country of everything. They have started nuclear blackmail. I'm not only talking about the attacks against Zaporozhye nuclear power station that is promoted by the Western curators, but I'm talking about the statements about high-level representatives of the NATO countries about the possibility of using weapons of mass destruction against Russia, nuclear weapons. And those who make such statements against Russia, I would like to remind them that our country also possesses various type of right weapons. And in some components, we have more modern weapons than NATO countries. And if the territorial integrity of our country is threatened, to defend and protect our country and our people, we will use all the means that we have. And I'm not bluffing.
Russian President Vladimir Putin, part of a TV address from Tuesday night. He also said he signed a decree on a partial mobilization of Russian citizens, those who've served in the armed forces before, to be conscripted back into the military to fight in Ukraine. President Joe Biden, in his speech today at the UN General Assembly in New York City, pointing to the coalition of 40 nations who have provided weapons and other aid in support of Ukraine.
A permanent member of the United Nations Security Council invaded its neighbor, attempted to erase a sovereign state from the map. Russia has shamelessly violated the core tenets of the United Nations Charter. No more important than the clear prohibition against countries taking the territory of their neighbor by force. Again, just today, President Putin has made overt nuclear threats against Europe and a reckless disregard for the responsibilities of the non-proliferation regime. Now, Russia's calling up more soldiers to join the fight, and the Kremlin is organizing a sham referendum to try to annex parts of Ukraine, an extremely significant violation of the UN Charter. This world should see these outrageous acts for what they are. Putin claims he had to act because Russia was threatened. But no one threatened Russia. And no one other than Russia sought conflict. In fact, we warned it was coming. And with many of you, we worked to try to avert it. Putin's own words make his true purpose unmistakable. Just before he invaded, Putin asserted, and I quote, Ukraine was created by Russia and never had, quote, real statehood. And now we see attacks on schools, railway stations, hospitals, one on centers of Ukrainian history and culture. In the past, even more horrifying evidence of Russia's atrocity and war crimes. Mass graves uncovered in Izium. Bodies, according to those who excavated those bodies, showing signs of torture. This war is about extinguishing Ukraine's right to exist as a state, plain and simple, and Ukraine's right to exist as a people. Whoever you are, wherever you live, whatever you believe, that should make your blood run cold.
President Biden at the United Nations General Assembly. It's the first all-in-person General Assembly at the UN since 2019, before the COVID-19 pandemic. President Biden also announcing today nearly $3 billion in new U.S. commitments to address global food shortages, which have been made worse by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, also by COVID-19 and supply chain problems. CNN has a story today. Two American veterans and five British citizens who had been held by Russian-backed forces for months have been released as part of a prisoner swap between Russia and Ukraine that was brokered by Saudi Arabia. Another CNN story has this. A Russian capsule took an American to space today, marking a notable continuation of the Russian-U.S. partnership in space in an era of great geopolitical tension. President Biden, in his speech to the UN, also touching on several other issues, including Iran, North Korea, and their nuclear programs.
Russia shunned the non-proliferation ideals embraced by every other nation at the 10th NPT review conference. And again today, as I said, they're making irresponsible nuclear threats to use nuclear weapons. China is conducting an unprecedented concerning nuclear buildup without any transparency. Despite our efforts to begin serious and sustained diplomacy, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea continues to blatantly violate UN sanctions. And while the United States is prepared for a mutual return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action if Iran steps up to its obligations, the United States is clear. We will not allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon. I continue to believe that diplomacy is the best way to achieve this outcome. The nonproliferation regime is one of the greatest successes of this institution. We cannot let the world now slide backwards.
President Biden addressing the UN General Assembly. That Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, was negotiated under former President Obama back in 2015. In 2018, former President Trump withdrew the U.S., and talks are continuing now under President Biden on having the U.S. rejoin. The Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, also speaking today at the U.N. General Assembly, saying that Iran does not wish to develop nuclear weapons, has no intention, but that Western countries need to abide by their side of the deal. An Associated Press article puts it this way. The 2015 agreement placed curbs on Iran's nuclear program in exchange for billions of dollars in sanctions relief, which Tehran insists it has never received. The Iranian president today also speaking about the importance of security guarantees.
The issue of guarantees is not just for something that may happen. We're basing that on lived experience. We're speaking of the experience of America having left the JCPOA. And we have a year and a half of negotiations with the current American government for her to return to the fulfillment of her commitments. And while today they speak of observing their commitments to this deal, They keep repeating the same old stories of the past, which puts a great deal of doubt on her true commitment to return to this agreement. Which brings us to another challenge. Can we truly trust without guarantees and assurances that they will this time live up to their commitment? Of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran, with various well-established and vast relationships with countries across the globe, has managed to neutralize, in many cases, the sanctions and created new opportunities. According to the United States of America herself, as announced many times by many government officials, the maximum pressure policy has suffered an embarrassing defeat. We have found our path independent of any agreement, and we will continue on that path steadfastly. At the same time, while we are very serious in the negotiations, and we have shown and we have proven that if the rights of the people of Iran are respected, there is a great and serious will to resolve all issues. We believe that the knot of the nuclear deal must be opened from the same place where they managed to tie this knot together.
The Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi, through an interpreter at the UN General Assembly in New York City. In his speech, he did not mention a week now of protests happening in his country following the death of a 22-year-old in custody of the Morality Police, which enforces the Islamic dress codes for women, such as having to wear a headscarf. Reuters says that the death has unleashed anger over issues including freedoms in the Islamic Republic and an economy reeling from sanctions. Women have waved and burnt their veils during protests, with some cutting their hair in public. This is Washington Today. Back in Washington, D.C., U.S. Senate ratifying an amendment to an international climate treaty that would reduce the use of hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs, potent greenhouse gas chemicals used as a refrigerant. This is known as the Kigali Amendment to the Montreal Protocol Treaty of 1987. And speaking on the Senate floor in support, Senator Tom Carper, Democrat from Delaware, chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee.
In 1988, this very body, the United States Senate, voted unanimously to ratify the Montreal Protocol, an international agreement to phase out ozone-depleting substances that was negotiated under President Ronald Reagan's leadership. And since then, the global consumption of ozone-depleting substances has declined by, get this, by 97%, while our economy has continued to grow. Now, that's good news. That's really good news. But unfortunately, there's some bad news. The HFCs that are used have been used for years now to replace the ozone-depleting substances have been found to also be bad for our environment. So in 2016, the global community got together and amended the Montreal Protocol to also phase down HFCs, hydrofluorocarbons. This is not the first time we've ratified an amendment to the Montreal Protocol. The Kigali Amendment before us is the fifth amendment to the Montreal Protocol ratified by the United States. The Kigali Amendment was transmitted to the United States Senate on November 16, 2021, almost a year ago, 300 days, in fact, ago. Each day that has passed without ratification represents a further delay in supporting American businesses, in supporting American workers, and in growing our economic and national security interests, and protecting our economic and national security interests. Thanks to American innovation, we now have HFC alternatives that are cleaner and more energy efficient than HFCs. And the best part, here's the best part, these cleaner, more efficient HFC alternatives are being manufactured, as I said, right here in the U.S. of A.
Senator Tom Carper is a Democrat from Delaware, chairs the Environment and Public Works Committee, speaking on the Senate floor today before the vote on this amendment to the treaty. Senator John Barrasso, Republican from Wyoming, is the top Republican on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. He voted no. He also spoke ahead of the vote.
We've already passed bipartisan legislation to reduce HFC consumption, and it has already become the law of the land. Many of the benefits and the jobs that are being touted are U.S. innovations. And it's a result of our domestic legislation, not ratification of some U.N. treaty. We did it here. We did it right. I say we don't need to get entangled now in another United Nations treaty. Our own law can be amended if we would like. It can be repealed. It can be replaced. Depending on the impact and cost, the U.S. can make changes quickly. It's much harder, if not impossible, to do it with an international treaty. In fact, when you take a look at the Kigali Treaty, an amendment, there's actually no way to withdraw from it if we ratify and join in. When I take a look at this, it is especially bad because it doubles down on the practice of treating China, yes, China, as a developing country. And the key word here is developing. China's not a developing country. But this treaty says they are a developing country. And it makes a big difference in terms of the treaty and the way that China is treated internationally, because it gives China special treatment. And I will tell you, Mr. President, they don't deserve the kind of treatment that they would get with this. Under this treaty, China would get an extra 10 years, an extra decade to produce HFCs. Well, this places us, the United States, at a competitive disadvantage to China for 10 additional years. Interestingly, and I think surprisingly to people, that when they hear this, the U.S. would also be expected to give more American taxpayer dollars to a UN, United Nations, multilateral fund that's set aside to help developing nations. The key word here is, again, developing, and they want to treat China like a developing country. So it would send more U.S. dollars to China because they have access to this UN multilateral fund.
Senator John Barrasso, Republican, on the Senate floor today. The Senate did adopt an amendment to this amendment to the bill, 96-0, that ensures China is not treated as a developing country under the treaty. And then ratifying the treaty itself, that requires a two-thirds vote of the Senate, and it got it. It passed 69-27, 21 Republicans joining the Democrats in voting yes. Wall Street Journal has an article that ratification has the support of climate advocacy groups and major business groups, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who said the move would help U.S. chemical manufacturers, which have spent billions of dollars developing alternative refrigerants and are eager to sell them to the fast-growing overseas market. But also in that article is this line: the tight margin underscores the political sensitivity of climate-related policy, even when business groups back the measure. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to you every day. Subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.